You are listening to WGNS.
The monthly District Attorney Show, heard the first Friday of each month, exclusively on News Radio WGNS.
The viewpoints and opinions expressed on this broadcast are the viewpoints and opinions of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the viewpoints and opinions of this show, its host, or the management of this station.
This is the WGNS Action Line, talking with Rutherford County newsmakers about what matters most to you.
Your host, J. Paul Newman of the monthly District Attorney Show, will now take you on a journey to explore recent Rutherford County court cases, cold cases, and more.
We welcome everyone to the program. My name is J. Paul Newman. My co-host today, Rutherford County Assistant District Attorney Trevor Lynch. We thank WGNS for providing the airtime. And we also thank our producer, Scott Walker. Most of all, we thank you for listening. On today's broadcast, in our Call to Conviction segment, we will profile another one of our super cases. It is the 1986 murder of Deborah Bess. Then we will request your help in solving a mystery in our cold case profile. It is the unsolved murder of Thomas Holland. And then Assistant District Attorney General Trevor Lynch will take us all inside the courts. We will begin our broadcast after you listen to these important messages.
Hi, this is Peter Demas with Demas's Restaurants. One of the new menu items that we have added is our Salmon Imperial. Our Salmon Imperial is a fresh cut piece of salmon with shrimp and a crab meat blend, and then we've put our Alfredo sauce on top of it. It's great for a low carb diet that you can get with spinach, but also it just has an amazing flavor with a mixture of all those flavors between the shrimp, Alfredo, and then our salmon. Please have your family join our family for lunch or dinner 7 days a week at Demas's.
The monthly District Attorney Show, heard exclusively on News Radio, WGNS, the first Friday of each month.
In our Call to Conviction segment, we will highlight a case that is one of Rutherford County's most memorable trial cases. It is a case that highlights the hard work and dedication of two Rutherford County detectives. Two detectives who, under the leadership of former Rutherford County Sheriff Truman Jones, were the first investigators assigned to the then newly formed Rutherford County Cold Case Unit. The two detectives were Bill Sharp and Dan Goodwin. Together, Detectives Sharp and Goodwin solved several cold case murders. At least five of these murders had remained unsolved for over 20 years. Sharp and Goodwin also helped other departments establish their own cold case units. Because of their amazing success, their work drew national attention, and they became recognized by many as the best cold case investigators in the state of Tennessee. Along with former District Attorney General Bill Weitzel, Jr., it was my honor to prosecute the cold case murders that were solved by Dan Goodwin and Bill Sharp. On today's program, we will highlight what many believe is their most important case. It is a case involving the 1986 murder of Deborah Bess.
From call to conviction, time now for a look back at one of the more intriguing and important cases for this community. From the crime, the investigation, to the prosecution.
Our case study today involves a case that spanned more than 28 years between the crime itself and the jury's verdict. It is a shining example of a model cold case investigation. It is the 1986 investigation into the death of 38-year-old Deborah Bess. We begin our story by going back in time. The date is August the 19th, 1986. The location is a trailer on Richland Richardson Road in Rutherford County, Tennessee. The Rutherford County Sheriff's Office has responded to a mobile home owned by Moses and Deborah Bess. Moses Bess meets the deputies outside of the trailer. He tells the deputies that his wife, Deborah, has just committed suicide. When the deputies enter the trailer, they locate the body of Deborah Bess. It is a gruesome and horrible scene. Deborah Bess's head had been completely destroyed. Her face was non-existent. Moses Bess tells the investigators that Deborah Bess told him to take care of the kids, and then that she placed a .44 Magnum pistol under her chin and pulled the trigger. There were small children present in the trailer, but they were not interviewed. Moses Bess was known to the police, and some of the investigators doubted his story. But Moses Bess claimed to be the only witness to the shooting. And although it seemed unlikely to the detectives that a woman would use a high-powered firearm to shoot herself in the face, no witness could contradict Bess's version of the events. For over 20 years, the case remained unsolved. Then, in 2011, Bill Sharp and Dan Goodwin, two dedicated Rutherford County cold case detectives, brought their unique skills, their perseverance, and their dedication in an effort to find the truth regarding the death of Deborah Bess. They reviewed the case file, re-interviewed the friends, family, and co-workers of Deborah Bess, and they also interviewed the small children who had been at the trailer that night. Their investigation also included interviewing former friends and neighbors of Moses Bess. They established that Deborah Bess had told friends that she was leaving Moses Bess that night. They also found out that the small children had actually witnessed the shooting and contradicted Moses Bess's version of the facts. After a year-long renewed investigation, Dan Goodwin and Bill Sharp had gathered enough evidence to present their case to the Rutherford County Grand Jury. In March of 2012, the Rutherford County Grand Jury indicted 63-year-old Moses Bess for the 1986 murder of Deborah Bess. The case was assigned to the courtroom of Judge David Bragg. The prosecution team consisted of District Attorney General William C. Weitzel, Jr., and Assistant District Attorneys J. Paul Newman and Matt Westmoreland. Moses Bess was represented by Murfreesboro attorneys Charles Ward and Derek Howard. After more than 2 years of pretrial proceedings, the case was eventually set for trial. The trial of Moses Bess began on June the 1st, 2015. The jury heard experts from the defense and the state. The defense expert maintained that he believed that Deborah Bess was under stress and may have committed suicide. The state expert took a different view of the facts. He said that Deborah Bess was not a suicide victim, that she was a victim of homicide. Also during the trial, witnesses testified that Moses Bess had told them that he killed Deborah Bess. Bess's son also testified. Now an adult, the son told the jury what he saw that night. He said he saw Moses Bess put a .44 Magnum pistol under Deborah Bess's chin, and the next thing he heard was a gunshot. And then he saw Deborah Bess on the floor. After 6 days of testimony, the jury left the courtroom to deliberate. Approximately 2 hours later, the jury returned with their verdict. The jury found Moses Bess guilty of murder in the first degree. Judge Bragg accepted the jury's verdict, and Judge Bragg sentenced Moses Bess to life in prison. Detectives Bill Sharp and Dan Goodwin had achieved what many thought was impossible. They had taken a 25-year-old cold case that needed further investigation, and by accepting that challenge, their efforts brought Moses Bess to justice. It is my honor now to have with us in the studio today Major Bill Sharp and Sergeant Dan Goodwin. We appreciate both of you taking the time to be here today. Before we delve into the case itself, I would like for each of you to tell us a little bit about yourself, and specifically what motivated you to choose law enforcement as your profession. Let's start with Major Bill Sharp.
Good morning, Paul. Thank you for having Dan and I on your show this morning. Well, you know, it's kind of a long walk from beginning to where I am today. I grew up in New Jersey in a kind of an implant and came back south where my father and my mother were raised. But we came to Murfreesboro and shortly thereafter moved over to Cannon County. So I consider myself a Cannon County boy. You know, as far as the career itself, I never had intentions of getting into law enforcement. You know, I had a career path set for maybe teaching and coaching because I enjoyed playing baseball and so forth. But I was offered an opportunity to go to work for the Woodbury Police Department in 1991. Former Chief Avery called me in and asked if I'd be interested coming in and going to work for his department. He knew I was in college, and he said he'd work around my schedule and help me finish my degree. So I spent about 2.5 years at Woodbury before having the opportunity to come work for Rutherford County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff Jones and Chief Gams at that time brought me in, interviewed me, and offered me a job. So after about a year, 2 years, it sort of stuck in my blood, and here I am today. I've had a great career, blessed career, and worked for some fine people there.
Now let's hear from Sergeant Dan Goodwin.
It's good to see you again, Paul. There's kind of a parallel track here. I, too, was an Air Force brat. My dad retired in 1970, and he moved us to a 40-acre patch of heaven in Cannon County. I went to high school there. I never set out to be a cop like Bill. I went in the Air Force the week after I graduated high school in 77, started at MTSU 81, got a degree in journalism, of all things, in 1985. I worked at a paper for a while that year, and then I went to the DNJ. By August of 1986, I was a cop reporter at the DNJ and heard about the death of Deborah Bess the next morning. I'll tell you a little bit about that later. What I saw was I was a lot more like the cops I was covering than the people I was sharing space with at the DNJ. Even so, I got promoted to city editor, but Sheriff Truman Jones offered me a job in 1992 in law enforcement. I jumped on it. Spent about 7 years in patrol, SRO, narcotics, and I transferred to CID and happened to partner up with this enormous man next to me, and folks started going to jail frequently as a result, and that's where we're at now.
My summary was brief, and I would like to ask you both a series of questions designed to tell us more about the investigation into the murder of Deborah Bess and the arrest 25 years later of Moses Bess. First, Major Sharp, this investigation was really a team effort, and it spanned over 25 years, beginning with the officers who responded to the scene and continuing throughout the investigation and ultimately ending with the arrest of Moses Bess. Who were some of those officers and what roles did they play in bringing Moses Bess to justice?
Well, Paul, excuse me, as you mentioned earlier, they received a call to the sheriff's office in reference to a shooting. Now, the irony of this is the person who received the call from the sheriff's office, or called the sheriff's office, was a Mr. Loretta Ewing. We've discussed, I think, in the past, the Ewing case, Charles Ewing, who was eventually arrested for killing his first wife. But anyway, she is the one who called the sheriff's office and stated that there had been a shooting at the Bess's residence. And she'd received that information from the Bess children who came running up. But shortly after, about 10:30 that night, the day of the shooting or the night of the shooting, deputies Glenn Morton and deputies Jim Gage arrived at the scene. Now, when they arrived at the scene as the first two patrol officers, they were met by several people sitting in the front yard, one of those being Moses Bess. Moses was in a calm state, but he was outside. The two deputies waited for further backup, and once the backup got there, they went into the residence. They waited for the detective to come out, and that detective was Rick Deal. Rick Deal was the original investigator on it. He was assisted by Randy Gross, who I may mention is still with us and doing investigative work still. But they entered the crime scene and collected, I would say, minimal amount of evidence, photographs and so forth. But over the years, you know, that case has sat there. But, you know, with the photographs and the crime scene sketch, until Dan and I picked up the case many years later. So really the two original investigators, Deal and Randy Gross.
Sergeant Goodwin, my next question is, this case began on August the 19th, 1986, and it lay dormant for more than two decades. What was it that caused you and Major Sharp to reopen this case in 2011?
Basically, we started getting in new information starting in May of 2011. After the death of a fellow named Alan Hall, a close criminal associate of Jewel Moses Bess. They lived right across the road from each other on Richard and LaRoad. And people, after Hall's death, started calling us and telling us about all kinds of crimes and killings on Hall's land, which they all referred to as the Ponderosa, and Moses' place called Moses Mountain. But the only crime we were told about that we knew had a solvability factor was the supposed suicide of Deborah Bess. We started learning about the many admissions by Moses to killing her within the first 2 days of our inquiry.
Sergeant Goodwin, in this case, there were some serious obstacles that you had to overcome. To understand the problems, we have to first understand the crime and its participants. First of all, the victim in this case was Deborah Bess. What can you tell us about her?
She was a divorced woman with two teenage daughters and a younger son in the early 1980s. She was originally from the Kittrell area, as was Moses, and she graduated from Kittrell School in 1966. Moses was a year behind her in high school. I don't think he graduated. But in the early 80s, Moses divorced his first wife but had their three sons in custody. Deborah started going to the many parties that occurred out there at Moses' place and started hanging around there, and they became an item, and she soon moved her girls, and I believe the boy stayed with his father. And while it sounds almost exactly like the Brady Bunch, it soon turned dark for her with a lot of domestic violence, horrible crimes that were being perpetrated on her and the kids. He called her his wife, but they didn't actually marry until 1986, just a few months before she was killed. And after she bore him two girls between the two of them, one of the most touching things we were told is the boys, Moses' boys, considered her to be the closest thing to a real mother that they ever had.
Major Sharp, can you tell us about Moses Bess?
Well, if we have about another hour and a half, we could probably talk that long on Moses. Moses was an interesting character, unique, to say it lightly, evil. But anyway, look, Moses is from a large family. There's been numbers saying anywhere from 14 to 17, 18 children in the family. He as well was from the Kittrell area. And Moses, shortly after turning of age, entered the military. Now, the part about the military is when Moses got back and returned from Vietnam, he started telling everybody that he was a tunnel rat and that he had killed many Vietnamese and soldiers and so forth, and it talked about his exploits as a tunnel rat. We found that not to be true. We found the fact that though he did serve, he was behind the lines. He was in, I think, wasn't it motor pool or transport, Dan?
Yes, sir.
And so anyway, after his time, he returned back to Murfreesboro and soon began his criminal activities, drugs and so forth. Moses fancied himself a biker. He had that. He thought he had that persona of being I want to say a Charlie Manson. That's how some people referred to him that we interviewed. The long hair, the beard. He would intimidate and try to entice younger people to do some of his dirty deeds. But he also started running with some known bad people, you know, that are no longer here, that that we've investigated on homicides as well. Moses used to run around with bells on his boots and large rings on his finger when he was beating people, and he would tell people that these are hell's bells, and he would want people to kiss his boots and call him God. So Moses was a just an evil person.
I want to ask you now about the arrest of Moses Vest. First of all, Sergeant Sharp, Major Sharp, where was he arrested, and why was he where he was when you arrested him?
Moses was arrested while he was incarcerated in state penitentiary. Moses had been sent to prison under where he had raped his daughter, and he was serving, I believe it was a 15-year sentence. And Detective Gross actually worked that case, which, you know, kind of funny how all the original detectives and so forth tie in. But Randy worked that case, and he was sentenced to 15 years in prison. And we knew that it was getting close to him flattening out his time. And we were able to, I think, wrap the case up and enough information to take it to the grand jury. And we didn't end up arresting him while he was in prison.
Sergeant Goodwin, from reviewing the autopsy, what injuries did Deborah Best suffer that caused her death?
Deborah Best died as a result of a massive gunshot wound to her head. The bullet passed through her head from under her right jaw and exited the top left side of her skull. The weapon used was, as you referenced earlier, an enormous 3.5-pound bone-handled Ruger 44 Magnum revolver. The most common load for that cartridge is a 240-grain jacketed hollow point going about 1,400 feet per second, an extremely powerful round. And one of the things he did was tell us that he'd bought that gun for her, and that is, she was a frail person. That's like lifting a bottle of Gain detergent. You know, that would not be something that a lady would use in that case. But our investigation showed that it was not a suicide. The manner was ruled as homicide by our investigation. The cause was that gunshot wound.
Major Sharp, it appears that from the very beginning of this case, Moses Best was always maintaining that this was a suicide. Was there any reason at the beginning of the investigation, or at any time shortly after that, to doubt Moses Best's version of the events?
I think the what people were basing that suicide on was the fact that no one had come forward, no one would testify, no one would say anything against Moses Best. Moses intimidated those who were there. The other thing about the crime scene itself is techniques and strategies and forensics have changed greatly from that time. Looking at the crime scene photographs, there are several, I won't say, but a couple things that were just glaring that showed that it's, in our mind, was not a suicide. The transfer of blood on the bed, the fact that there's blood on the waterbed and the sheets were removed. However, we know that there were sheets on the bed prior to that. But the fact that no one would come up and say, and Moses was the only, quote, witness to it, that's one reason I think is never pursued as a homicide until we were able to find people to start talking.
Sergeant Goodwin, why do you think this case became a cold case?
Well, as Bill referenced, you know, I said earlier, I actually heard about it the next day, and it was a news story because you don't report on suicides, but it always stuck in my mind exactly what the sergeant there, Sergeant Gammon, told me that morning. He said, I asked him what happened every night. I went there every morning. And he said, well, the biggest drug dealer in the county blew his wife's head off, but we have no way to prove it. So it was ruled a suicide. The obstacles included, like Bill said, the ongoing fear of Moses Best, even though he'd already been locked up for 13 years in the state prison. People were afraid that he and his henchmen would be able to get at them if they told the truth. But the passage of time, which is always our friend, and the death of witnesses were also a problem. One of our key witnesses died just months before the trial in 2013, and another, dying of cancer, had to be deposed in a federal prison in Florida. We knew we had with the key when we found three eyewitnesses to deliver a contact headshot to Deborah, and that was Moses Boys.
Major Sharp, was there a moment when you realized that you had enough to charge Moses Best? And if so, do you remember when that moment was?
I think when his son came forward, among others, but when his son said that he recalls seeing how Deborah was lying on the floor, which was contradictory to what Moses was saying, and really matched what we found in our investigation as far as the blood spatter, the transfer and all that, I think that was the point where I felt very confident And the fact that people were able to come forward, Paul, as I don't know if you remember, but there was a neighbor that lived down the road from Moses, just out of high school, maybe college age or so forth. But he had walked down to Moses, drove down to Moses' house one night, and Moses asked him if he had been the one shooting this gun and what type of guns, because Moses was always interested in guns. And this young man told him that it was a .44 Magnum. Well, Moses stood up, and if you can picture it, stood up and walked over to this young man and put it underneath, put his finger underneath his chin and pulled a trigger and mentioned that he killed his wife. I killed her, and this is how I did it. So at that moment, you know, you had his son giving us information, the positive information about the way the body was, which matched what Dan and I and others had thought. And then this young man who had nothing to do with the Moses family, that inner circle, just a random neighbor. So at that point, we started feeling real good about it.
Detective Goodwin, what role did the friends and coworkers of Deborah Best play in their investigation?
Her female friends within the group that they hung around with on the mountain were able to testify to a lot of physical and mental abuse that Deborah suffered for years at his hands. Her coworkers at Cracker Barrel also told us how he stalked her while she was at work, and all of the ladies confirmed that she planned to divorce him and was actively planning to run away and get that divorce, take custody of his sons, and get custody of his property.
Major Sharp, this was the seventh cold case that the Rutherford County Sheriff's Office solved since its formation. Is there any one thing about this case that will always stay with you?
I think the fact that when we met Moses to interview Moses is something that we talked to the family about as well. But when we first met Moses, he tried to intimidate, and that's Moses Best. I recall vividly him coming up, shaking my hand, and a lot of times when people try to establish dominance, they'll try to roll the hand over and so forth. And he made eye contact, and it's important and very imperative that I didn't break eye contact with him. And once he stopped, and it seemed like hours, but it's just a few seconds before he broke his eye contact. And that's what we told the family as well. When they came in to testify, when he came into the courtroom, that's what he would try to do, is test, you know, intimidate. But I think what sticks in my mind is just, this man is evil. And I mean, we've worked some terrible cases, but the things that this man has done and said, he's probably the most evil person I've come across in this many years of law enforcement.
And Sergeant Goodwin, the same question.
That it's the little things that matter. People need to tell the cops what they know when there's a crime. Those ladies could have come forward back then, and that would have gotten the investigation rolling. But mostly it's the bravery of two children who were there that night. One was 18 months old, the daughter, Mariah. That's no longer her name. It's been changed legally. He finally got a measure of justice for Deborah Best. She was on the bed when her mama was killed. She's also the one he molested 15 years later and got sent to prison for, because she realized finally what was going on, and she broke his head pretty good with a frying pan and called 911. And that led to him going to prison, which made this county a much safer place. And it also started removing his base of power. She made him a fixed target. And then when her half-brother, Michael, testified to what he'd seen in a very emotional way, that sealed Moses' fate. I know he's not going to be eligible for parole until 2038, and he'll be nearly 90. I won't be too far behind him, 10 years. And I'm hoping Bill is in good enough shape to drive us up there to testify against his release, or maybe we can get an Uber.
We want to thank both of you and the other members of the Rutherford County Sheriff's Office for the excellent work that was performed in bringing Moses Best to justice. The Moses Best conviction shows us all that a murder case is never too cold to be rewarned and reinvestigated. This is true because in a murder case, justice does not have an expiration date.
This is Paul Newman. When we return, we will be asking for your help in solving a mystery in our cold case profile. You are listening to this special edition of The Action Line on WGNS.
You feel great at Adam's Place.
Melanie teaches all of our exercise classes. I do the stretch and balance.
Alan Butcher.
Avis is our water aerobics instructor. It's really helped me to overcome some of my arthritis pain, and it's just a wonderful thing that we have here.
Hi, this is Terry Deal at Adam's Place. Call me for more information about Adam's Place. Phone 615-904-9111.
Adam's Place on Memorial, across from Walmart.
Every homicide, every rape, every robbery affects the entire community. People who are victims of these crimes need closure. The people who committed these crimes must be held accountable. Law enforcement needs the community's help in seeking justice. Please listen as we review an unsolved mystery in this month's Cold Case Profile.
On today's Cold Case Profile, we will be asking for your help in solving a brutal murder. The date was May the 17th, 2020, and the time was approximately 5 a.m. when the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to a duplex in the 700 block of East Northfield Boulevard. Upon their arrival, the police discovered the lifeless body of 45-year-old Thomas Holland. The body is laying on the duplex driveway. Thomas Holland had been shot several times. Murfreesboro Police Detective Cody Thomas was assigned as the lead investigator on the case. As part of the investigation, an autopsy was conducted, and it was determined that Thomas Holland had been drinking prior to the shooting. Detectives also believed that there may have been an altercation that led up to Thomas Holland's death. Early in the investigation, the Murfreesboro Police Department did develop one person as a possible suspect. However, later investigators were able to exclude that person as not being responsible for the death of Thomas Holland. The Murfreesboro Police Department continues their investigation. But as of today, no one has been arrested for this brutal crime. Thomas Holland lived in Murfreesboro, and he had been a volunteer at the Greenhouse Ministries. We ask that you please join law enforcement and Thomas Holland's family in seeking justice for Thomas Holland. If you have any information regarding the murder of 45-year-old Thomas Holland, please contact the Murfreesboro Police Department. The number to call is 615-893-2717. That number again is 615-893-2717. Or you can email your information to crimetips@murfreesborotn.gov. That email address again is crimetips@murfreesborotn.gov. And if you wish to remain anonymous, you can provide your confidential information through Crime Stoppers. If your information leads to an arrest and a conviction in this case, you may be eligible to receive up to $1,000. The number to call is 615-893-7867. That number again is 615-893-7867. Please help us bring closure to those who knew and loved Thomas Holland, and help us to bring justice to whoever caused his death. This is J. Paul Newman, and this has been today's Cold Case Profile.
We're broadcasting from the Middle Tennessee Electric Studios. Visit MTE.com.
Get old. Old National Bank, that is. Old National Bank has the experience and service you need to buy a home, make investments, even online and mobile banking. Old National Bank is in the borough on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard.
Old National Bank at 2230 Dr. MLK Jr. Boulevard, which used to be Mercury Boulevard.
Visit us and enjoy warm, homemade cookies at Old National Bank.
Old National Bank, Equal Housing Lender, Member FDIC.
The Action Line on FM 101.9 and AM 1450 Murfreesboro, FM 100.5 Smyrna. Listen and watch at WGNSradio.com. This is Inside the Courts. A look at this month's trials, pleas, and grand jury action. Inside the Courts is presented as a courtesy of the Rutherford County Clerk's Office.
Good morning, everyone. This is Assistant District Attorney Trevor Lynch, and today I will be your tour guide through this episode of Inside the Courts. We begin this segment by stating that the defendants named in upcoming trials or hearings have not been convicted, and they are presumed by our law to be innocent. With that as a prelude, we will now go inside the courts. A trial is scheduled to begin March 10th of this year on Dontorius and Donsley Hamler for second-degree murder, two counts of attempted second-degree murder, six counts of aggravated assault, employing a firearm during an offense, and reckless endangerment. Mr. Hamler is represented by counsel Mr. Ben Wetzel, and Ms. Hamler is represented by counsel Ms. Jennifer Fiola. The state is represented by Assistant District Attorneys Matt Westmoreland and Trevor Lynch. A trial is scheduled to begin April 28th of this year on Dante Martin on allegations of first-degree murder, attempted first-degree murder, two counts of aggravated assault, reckless endangerment, carrying a weapon on school property, employing a firearm during a dangerous felony. The defendant is represented by counsel Mr. Jacob Finley, and the state is represented by Assistant District Attorney Matt Westmoreland. Pending in our courts, State v. Corey Munsell Lillard Sr. On March 9th of last year, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to a 911 call for shots fired at a residence on East Vine Street in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Upon arrival, officers discovered Mr. Davion Gates lying unresponsive in the driveway of a residence suffering from multiple gunshot wounds. Mr. Gates died from his injuries. Detective Justin Fugit of the Murfreesboro Police Department was assigned as lead investigator. Multiple persons lived in the residence, and officers learned that the 23-year-old gunshot victim was a romantic partner of one of these residents, a 41-year-old female. Also at the residence was 44-year-old Corey Munsell Lillard Sr. Mr. Lillard is the father of several of the female residents' children. Mr. Lillard was also staying at the residence at the time of the shooting. Detective Fugate interviewed multiple witnesses and were also able to view video jail calls between Mr. Lillard and one of his sons that was incarcerated at the Rutherford County Adult Detention Center. Mr. Lillard was on a video call with his son at the time of the shooting. From a review of this video, as well as evidence collected on scene, Mr. Lillard was charged with first-degree murder, maintaining a dwelling, possession of a Schedule II drug with intent, possession of drug paraphernalia, and possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. A preliminary hearing was held on June 18th of last year before a General Sessions Court, and probable cause was found to bind the matter over for presentment to a Rutherford County grand jury. In December of last year, the grand jury indicted Mr. Lillard for all charges. The defendant is represented by counsel, Mr. John Slager, and the state is represented by Assistant District Attorney Matt Westmoreland. This matter is scheduled for appearance in the Circuit Court on March 21st of this year. On April 23rd of last year, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to a 911 call for shots fired on South Rutherford Boulevard in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Upon arrival, officers discovered the body of Mr. Paul Howell on the roadway. Mr. Howell had been shot in his throat. Mr. Howell died as a result of his injury. Detective Andrew Stahlnicker of the Murfreesboro Police Department was assigned as lead investigator. Also on scene was Mr. Brian Craig, a friend of Mr. Howell's. Mr. Craig had sustained a single gunshot wound to the arm. Witnesses to the shooting reported a road rage incident where Mr. Howell and Mr. Craig were nearly run off the road by an unknown driver. All parties came to a stop at a red light, and a verbal altercation led to shots being fired by the unknown driver. Almost 30 minutes after the incident was reported, Mr. Joseph Gann called 911 to report that he was the shooter. Mr. Gann was interviewed along with multiple witnesses. And at the conclusion of the initial investigation, Mr. Gann was charged with second-degree murder, attempted second-degree murder, and reckless endangerment. Mr. Gann is represented by counsel, Mr. Josh Crane. The state is represented by Assistant District Attorneys Trevor Lynch and Matt Westmoreland. This matter was bound over by agreement and awaits presentment to a Rutherford County grand jury. On May 15th of last year, officers with the Murfreesboro Police Department responded to 911 call of shots fired at a gas station on Joe B. Jackson in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Officers discovered the body of Mr. Davon Lortz. Mr. Lawrence had been shot multiple times in the back and died from his injuries. Officers also located Mr. Eric Mitchell, the brother of Mr. Lawrence. Mr. Mitchell had been shot once in the arm and beaten across the head, face, and body. Also on scene were Mr. Juan Charco and his brother. The altercation was captured on video surveillance. Detective William Pulleas was assigned as lead investigator. Upon conclusion of the investigation, officers discovered that Mr. Charcoal and his brother were in the process of illegally transporting a vehicle that was owned by Mr. Lovitz from Atlanta to Nashville, Tennessee, without Mr. Lovitz's knowledge or consent. Mr. Lovitz and his brother, Mr. Mitchell, confronted Mr. Charcoal and his brother and took the vehicle back at gunpoint. When Mr. Lovitz and Mr. Mitchell were attempting to drive away in their own vehicles, Mr. Charcoal retrieved a semi-automatic rifle and shot over 25 times at the two men. Mr. Charco was charged with second-degree murder and attempted second-degree murder. This matter was bound over by agreement, and a Rutherford County grand jury indicted Mr. Charco for first-degree murder, attempted first-degree murder, aggravated assault, tampering with evidence, theft of property, reckless endangerment, and employing a firearm during commission of a dangerous felony. The defendant is represented by counsel Mr. Jeffrey Jackson, and the state is represented by Assistant District Attorneys Trevor Lynch and Matt Westmoreland. This matter is next scheduled to appear before a circuit court judge this year. And that concludes this episode of Inside the Courts.
The monthly District Attorney Show, heard exclusively on News Radio, WGNS, the first Friday of each month. The monthly District Attorney Show, heard exclusively on News Radio, WGNS, the first Friday of each month.
If you missed any part of this program, it will be available shortly as a podcast on the WGNS website.
As we end our program today, we thank our producer, Scott Walker. We thank WGNS for providing the airtime. Most of all, we thank you for listening. We leave by saying, a safe community is the responsibility of each and every one of us. For my co-host,
Assistant District Attorney General Trevor Lynch,
this is Paul Newman, bidding all of you a safe and blessed day.
The District Attorney's Office thanks you for listening to today's program. If you have any information regarding criminal activity in our community, please contact one of our law enforcement agencies. The information presented on today's show is solely for informational benefit and not intended to be legal advice. You should always consult an attorney whenever you need or rely on legal advice. Rutherford County's most trusted name in news. Talk Radio WGNS, Murfreesboro.